Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
From the bridge of the good ship Sci-Fi Wire, this is episode 3 of The Churn, a podcast about The Expanse. And today we're talking about episode 4 of The Expanse Season 2, Godspeed. My name's Adam Swiderski. I am the editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi Wire, and joining me, as always, is...
Cher Martinetti, via satellite.
From across the ether. Yeah, Cher got infected with a little touch of the proto-molecule this week. I think it's going to clear up. She's got some Robitussin.
I do. So. She's been puffing on it.
But, yeah, and we will be talking, of course, as always, with Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, the creators of the Expanse universe. And we will also be joined this week by Hottie McHotpants, Stephen Strait.
I mean, we really Captain have to talk about this because you're starting to worry me with your Stephen Strait obsession.
Well, it's going to get really awkward when he gets on the line and I'm just like, tell me about your abdominal workout routine. Let's talk about that for half an hour.
Maybe don't do that.
So you got that to look forward to, folks. But seriously, if you are, thank you for joining us on The Churn. And if you are enjoying what you're hearing, we would love for you to go to iTunes and rate and review us. Let us know what you think. Comment on the story where you find this. And yeah, get in touch. You can get in touch with us on Twitter as well, at Sci-Fi Wire, and let us know what you want to hear from The Expanse and The Churn. So here we go. Episode 4, Season 2. Episode 4s of this show so far have been kind of...
intense.
The episode where everything starts to happen. Because, wow, was there a lot going on this week. We had Vassarala finally starting to make her move. We have Jules-Pierre Mao shaking things up with Ehrenreich. And then the big thing, of course, is the realization of the plan that Miller and Fred Johnson came up with last week to launch the Naboo at Eros and push it into the sun. And yeah, everybody from Tycho kind of chipping in on that one and take some interesting twists and turns. Cher, what was your impression of this episode?
I mean, I think that there's been a lot going on this season, to be honest. But I do like that you saw their plan like come into fruition. I like that there were a couple of little funny quips by Amos. I kind of have a feeling I know where this is going. I don't want to spoil it for people that maybe don't know because they haven't like read the books, but I'm pretty positive we know where this is going. And I feel like every week is going to get more anxiety inducing, like more intense, which is great from a show standpoint, because like, that's what you want. And I feel like the way the episodes have been ending with like something's about to happen next week, I think that's always a good thing because that makes you tune in next week, you know? So I'm into it. And the spaceship designs were amazing.
That was very cool. I didn't mean to imply, by the way, that things hadn't happened up to this point. I just feel like this was definitely the most propulsive episode yet of this season. Really high stakes action going on. Although I will say, I'm not usually the biggest fan of the Earth of Vassarala stuff, but I loved her smiling while she was reading Jules-Pierre Mao, while she was giving him the business today. Or in this episode, that was fun for me because it was nice. We've seen her be hard and we've seen her be political, but to see her just kind of, you know, sitting there with that pleasant smile while she basically told him that she's onto his shit and, you know,
and
she's not going to stand for it was really kind of neat.
We had 2 F-bombs this week. Last week we had 1. I'm wondering if we're going to be ramping up the F-bombage.
Yeah. Hi, Ty. Hi, Daniel. How are you guys doing?
Oh, doing all right. Happy to be here.
Welcome to the show once again.
I think, but I'm not sure. I think maybe Steven's already on the line, too.
Hello?
See?
Mr. Strait!
Ah, there we go.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
That was really good. It was like your Steven Strait sense went off, Cher.
I know, it did.
Just
not
sneaking
that
in.
even, I didn't have an alarm. That would be more Adam's thing because he has an unhealthy obsession with you right now. So I'm just forewarning.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready, Adam. Let's hear it.
It's totally and completely healthy. I don't want to scare you off this early. Give me some time and we'll scare you off. It's okay. Not right off the bat.
All right, man. No worries.
So anyway, so thanks for joining us this week on The Churn. I guess we can jump right in with you. We're talking about episode 4 of season 2,
okay,
which is the big launching the Naboo at Eros episode.
Right.
Some big moments for Holden in this. We kind of see him have to deal with his idealism versus pragmatism. What was that like for you in terms of the development of the character?
This episode in particular, the ever-increasing responsibility that he feels towards people that are affected by the proto-molecule, it's one in a series of events that continue to push Holden into a grayer, more pragmatic moral code. And it's hard. You know, I wanted to be sure to show how difficult it is for Holden in becoming a competent, passionate leader. You see him struggle and stumble and hurt. And, you know, I didn't want it to be a clean trajectory from him, you know, being this kind of slacker on the Canterbury to being this, you know, upfront, forthright hero. I mean, it's hard for him to get there. And episode 4 in season 2 is a perfect example of that evolution happening. And that's a very clear one. I mean, I think the doctor's incident is a huge deal for Holden. And there's really kind of no coming back to his idealism after that. I mean, he's well on his way.
I was really struck by the fact that he pushes the button himself.
Yeah.
Rather than giving the order to fire, I thought that was a nice little nod to the fact that he's willing to take responsibility for it.
And his hand was like shaking. So you could tell that he was like hesitant.
Holden, you know, from the very beginning becomes embroiled in this by, you know, by circumstance. I mean, he answers that distress call in the beginning of season 1 and the dominoes start to fall for him. And, you know, in this episode, you really see how large the arc is for him. You know, he's in this crazy circumstance where he has to essentially execute this group of humanitarians, these doctors, for the sake of everyone else, just to be sure. And I think, you know, in the beginning of season 1, that would be incomprehensible to Holden. I don't think he would have been capable then. But in this season and in this episode in particular, I mean, he knows the kind of guilt that one feels over the, you know, the loss of other people's lives. It's what drives him from the beginning. I mean, he still thinks the Canterbury is his fault, even if it may not be. He certainly feels that way. And the proto-molecule and all this stuff, he feels not wholly responsible, but definitely involved somehow. And I think he feels a moral responsibility to take on as much of that burden as he can. And he doesn't want to impose that on this family that he's created, that they found themselves together. No, that shouldn't be anybody else's responsibility. And Holden takes it for himself. And, you know, his trajectory into a more gray character, you know, pushes itself big time after that, for sure.
Now, Ty and Daniel, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm not remembering this 100% right, but the Marasmus incident wasn't in the books. Is that correct?
No, it's not in there. It was created for the show, so specifically so we could give Holden a real crisis point that was external to himself. It wasn't something that he was going through in his head like we do in the books, where he had an external force acting on him, where he had to make a terrible decision that had consequences for himself and for people around him. I think it's the kind of thing we would put in the book. It's definitely fits exactly with the kind of mythology we're doing and sort of how we've designed Holden's character arc. But it was specifically for the show and specifically for Steven.
We actually have a question that we got on Twitter and somebody wanted to know. So they were saying they love how Holden is allowed to be such an emotional dude, and how you prepared for his mental and emotional state in season two, because he's obviously a lot of this stuff, like, you know, Daniel just said, it's not in your head or in the character's head. You're actually having it happen.
Right. Yeah. It was, there was a lot of research to do actually on Holden's trajectory in season two. I mean, he's a guy who wears his flaws in his sleeve, and he's unapologetically, you know, who he is from the very beginning. You know, in this season, and especially after Eros, at the end of season one, you know, he and Miller are really the only two people left at this point who have experienced the horror of what happened on Eros in a very personal way. And what I did in preparation for him this year was try to plot out and execute the most realistic version of him going through this PTSD experience after Eros and becoming increasingly obsessed with getting rid of the cause of it. And I spoke to one of the lead psychologists in the Canadian military before we started the show. We shoot up in Toronto, so we had access to them up there. And I asked him a bunch of questions about what it was like for peacekeepers in genocidal zones and conflicts like Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, you know, Bosnia and Kosovo and whatnot, and what the effect was on those who were there, who came back feeling somewhat helpless to stop the carnage and also taking on the responsibility of what they'd witnessed. And for me, Holden's journey this year is pushed directly by the things he experiences on Eros, along with you know, the things that happened before that with the Canterbury and whatnot. But when it gets to Eros, it stops being it's always a personal journey, but it stops being entirely personal. It's not just about justice for the Canterbury. Now it involves everybody. And the, you know, the greater his sphere of responsibility and the greater the sphere of the effect of the protomolecule amongst everybody by this point, the more crushing it is for Holden. And, and you know, him being an emotional and flawed guy, I think allows me as the actor and allows the audience, I think, to see how difficult these transitions are. They aren't clean. They don't just happen overnight. They stumble and fumble. And, you know, he's in a tremendous amount of pain this season. And most of the research done for that was done, you know, looking through, you know, books about soldiers coming back from war and talking to psychologists in the military and also reading the books, you know, and going over the books again and again and continuing to dig into Holden's psyche and why he reacts the way he does.
How far along in the books are you?
I've read the first three. I didn't want to go past that. I read the first two before I had started the show, just as a fan. And I didn't want to go past the third one just because I didn't want to know what Holden was going to become. I didn't want to get ahead of myself because I felt like I'd have it in the back of my mind as I was performing it. So I stopped myself at three, but I'm looking forward to pushing on.
That's kind of too bad, Stephen, because in book four is where Holden turns into a sex robot. I really feel like you would enjoy that.
You know, I had a suspicion. I felt like it was always going that direction, Ty.
Yeah, no, it's not subtle.
The clues are there right from the beginning. I mean,
wait, so like last week, Ty, you said that Amos is your id. And is Holden, like, you know, basically how you see yourself, actually? Because I know you write a good amount of that character.
Not really. It's Holden is interesting because he and I are almost nothing alike, but I feel like I really get where he's coming from. I feel like I understand why he does the things he does, and I'm very sympathetic to his worldview. I'm much more cynical than he is, at least in the earlier books. But yeah, I mean, he and I are very different, but he's different in ways that I get. Like, I wish more people were like Holden, even though I know I'm not. I think the world would be a better place if we had a little more of that idealism, a little more of that belief that humans can do the right thing if you give them all of the information. Even if I personally don't believe that's true, I love that Holden does.
You had mentioned that the Marasmus scene, you said at the end that it was written for Steven, and I guess I wanted to ask, like, how much has Steven's work in season one influenced the way the character is written in season two? Has there been anything where you change something or take a particular direction because of what Steven brings to the role?
I mean, you can't help, speaking it for the writer's room, you can't help but watch the performance and say, this actor is really good at this kind of thing. Let's find lots of places to put that kind of thing in. Of course you're going to do that. You want to see your performers do the kind of work that they seem to really dig into and get their teeth chewing into. So you try to write those kinds of scenes. And if you don't do that, it's stupid, because you have people who have these amazing gifts and talents for specific kind of work. Why wouldn't you let them turn that loose?
Steven, how do you feel that when you were reading in the books and kind of getting the scripts and everything, was there anything that you particularly applied direction-wise to the character that you might not have seen on the page? I mean, obviously your performance brings something because it's your performance, but was there anything where you were like, I kind of want to take this in this direction?
Well, I mean, I got the architecture for Holden's arc and journey from the books. I mean, it's all there. But, I think, why I loved the books to begin with, even before I started on the show, was the incredible sense of realism and humanity that permeates the entire story. It was unlike most any other science fiction I had ever read before. I wanted to make sure that there was that warmth, there was that humanity behind Holden, because that ultimately is what makes him the leader he is. It's his heart, because he makes mistakes, and he is flawed, and he has all these other qualities that could perhaps, put people in danger and regularly does, but he's got, this warmth of his idealism and of his spirit that I wanted to really make sure came across. I wanted him to be relatable, and I wanted to show that, this guy who really, wanted nothing to do with the greater responsibilities of the solar system at large, how this regular guy steps up to the plate at every step of the way, and it's really, really hard. Because it felt honest, it felt like an honest way to approach it. And that was there in the books. It was the feeling behind the plot that really struck me. It was that warmth. So I took that tone from the books and tried to apply it the best I could.
How much of Holden would you say that you have in common with him?
I think there's a lot of it, that I can relate to. I mean, that's your job really as an actor, isn't it? I mean, it's to find, what you can relate to, what you can empathize with, what you love and hate about each character you play. But with Holden, what struck me, is his vast arc, from being this kind of black and white, morally ideological guy who has this incredible idealism over what what people are capable of and what the solar system and the greater kind of sphere of humanity should be like if everything were done the right way, and to see him kind of shoulder more and more responsibilities and not lose the idealism. I consider myself an idealist in a lot of ways. But as you get older and as you take on more responsibilities and whatnot, obviously, that's tempered a bit based on, just pragmatic situations and life in general. But, you know, for me, it was his idealism and his struggle to hold on to it, that I connected to personally. I feel like I have that within me.
It's been pointed out that you are not on, and that was actually one of the questions. They want to know why you're not on social media, which, for the record, I think is a very smart move, but let's hear it.
Well, there's two reasons, personal and professional. I mean, personally, I just happen to be a really private person. So, you know, the constant interaction on social media, you know, makes me a little uncomfortable. And the other is professional. And, you know, it's something that I've thought a lot about. And you don't want to know too much about the performers that are playing your roles, at least in my opinion. And it's obviously a very personal opinion, and there's no right or wrong way to do it or not do it. But the more I know about a performer I'm watching, the harder it is to suspend my disbelief on what he or she is trying to portray. I don't know. It seems antithetical to, a bit of a hindrance, to share too much, about who you are as a person or what your life is like, if you're expecting people who are watching you to forget all of those things and take on the characteristics of the characters you're playing. So, you know, for me, it's both. It's both that I'm personally just not, it just makes me uncomfortable, and professionally, I can't see a way that it helps me as an actor do my job better. I mean, I certainly see the commercial ramifications for it, or the monetary ones, but that's not my priority. So I just try to do everything I can to make sure I can act the best I can.
Do you mean that?
But
you
think of all the cat videos you're missing out on.
Say, like, you're missing out on, like, slowly or fastly falling into madness with the rest of us that see, like, what's going on in the real world on social media.
It's not something I've ever been a part of. And I started acting, when I was really young, and, it wasn't part of the business yet. And, it's just not something that I've been able to wrap my head around, but I'm okay with it. You know, I'm content. I'm content, not being on it.
So when Dominique was on a couple of weeks ago and I asked her who she thought would win in an arm wrestling match between her and Frankie, she said that she definitely couldn't take Frankie, but she said that she could beat you in an arm wrestling match. So what do you have to say to that?
I know better than to argue with Naomi Nagata. I'm sure she could. She's awfully tough. She totally could.
Because I told her I was going to instigate this because I, you know, by the time everybody hears this, this will be after the premiere, but we're actually going to see you guys in a couple of days. So I was like, I'm going to instigate this the first chance I have. And since it's like, I have that chance, I might have to instigate this when we see you guys in a couple of days.
So. We're going to arm wrestle? We're going to arm wrestle live?
I would, listen, hit the gym, work out. Be prepared, because you just do not know what's about to come your way. I'm just letting you know.
It's going
to
be like that amazing Stallone movie from the 80s. When he's
yes.
Like a truck driver.
Like, which one? They're all <Right. amazing. laughs>
The one where he's like arm wrestling across America.
Yes. Amazing. Oh my God. Oh my, what is it called?
It's called Over the Top.
Over the Top. Over
yes.
The Top.
That's,
over the
that's
top.
Right. Over the Top. We're going to have an Over the Top night.
With an amazing, we'll get the Sammy Hagar theme song. It'll be amazing.
Yes. What are the odds that you can write in a, like, Stallone-esque Rocky workout montage for season 3 for the crew? Because I think that needs to happen.
We have a lot of writers. It doesn't have to just be us. We can get the whole room in on it. We'll find something.
But you're the two writers that are on this pod right now. So until I have a chance to, like, infect everybody with this amazing idea,
I really like the idea of Alex deciding that's what he needs to do, so we can have scenes of him flying the Rossi while he's got that weight. Yeah, He's got that weight hooked up, so he's like pumping weights with his right arm while he's flying, like Stallone had in the cab of his truck. I totally want to see that, where Alex just gets completely jacked in one.
Yeah,
arm.
It's like fat, it's like giant, like fat arm. Like,
oh, there's more than one person. There's more than one person who would like that sequence to happen.
Yeah.
I'm so in. Can we please make that happen? That'd be amazing.
See? You need me on your team, guys. You need me. I'm the idea person here, clearly.
We need one episode where everyone is just working out for the full hour. That's all it is.
The thing is, Kaz Anbar would be pissed because we'd be like, no, working out that one arm doesn't actually make your fat gut go away.
You should have him doing that prancer. Remember, like, the prancer workout? Like,
prancer
size. Prancer size.
Yeah.
Have Alex do prancer
amazing.
Size.
Or he could be like the guy, has anyone seen M. Night Shyamalan's Lady in the Water? There was that guy who just worked out one side of his body. So he was like totally jacked on one side of his body and the other side was normal. That could be it.
No, that sounds perfect.
Why
yeah.
I saw that.
This is all gold. I hope you guys, you know, make sure to give me and Cher a credit if this ends up in an episode.
But it's very important that there has to be the music to the montage has to include a saxophone solo. Otherwise, like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Past the show into some other kind of entertainment here.
I was going to say this conversation had gone completely off the rails, but we did say we would talk about Holden's workout routine when we had Steven on here. So there you go. Mission accomplished.
So here comes the creepy obsession part. Go ahead.
What? No, I'm not obsessed. Listen, I just think I was just like we had an episode. I think that was episode one, the airlock, sexy time with Holden and Naomi. And I got to say, man, Holden's abs were the most impressive special effect on the show that week. And it sticks with you.
You're very kind. Thank you.
I just want to know, is it in your contract that the first episode of every season you have to bare your ass? Is that in your contract?
I mean, am I supposed to say time, Daniel? I mean, I don't know. It just kind of fell out. It just kind of came out that way, I guess, so to speak.
Here's the deal. When you have that amazing of an app on the cast, you're doing yourself a disservice by not working it into as many scripts as you can.
You find people's talents and you write to them, right?
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you very much. My ass did amazing work at acting school.
It really did.
Valedictorian.
So,
yeah.
You can tell me emotion.
I don't want to turn away from this forever, but I wanted to touch base and say that really, I think Steven's job with Holden is probably one of the most difficult ones on the show, just because Holden is the central character of this 9-book sequence and has the longest and most kind of subtle, slow progression to go through. You know, all ass works out to side. Right. I'm really impressed.
Golf clap for both Steven and his ass's performances. Golf clap.
Right.
I will say, as a book reader, you know, Holden has some, and without giving away too many spoilers, Holden has some interesting mental territory coming up. Do you want to, I guess, again, if you can do it without giving too much away, how does you go about preparing for that? Like, you talked about speaking to people about like PTSD and things, but this is a whole different level of what's coming. What's that process like?
It's going to be difficult to talk about it without giving too much away, but I think I'm going to take the same approach. I mean, with Holden this year, I took a psychological approach to it. You know, I wanted to portray, just how realistic, this trajectory was for Holden this year. And as time goes on, I'm going to continue for that to be the case. You know, ideally, I want the people watching it to go through it with him and to see, the kind of vulnerabilities that these new paradigm shifts throw Holden. And like you said, I mean, there's some major territory coming up that I'm really excited to explore and dig into. But it's really fun, man. It's really fun. I mean, it's not often that you get the privilege to play a guy who's going through such a journey in such an interesting way. There's definitely some amazing stuff to come, and I'm just going to try and stick to, portraying it as realistically as I possibly can.
It's so hard because there's so many things I want to ask about, and I can't without giving anything away. Ah,
I know. I can't really give you an answer without giving shit away either. So yeah. I know. I feel you, man. I feel you.
So when Wes was on last week, I asked him like how much, because Amos is a very chill person. I asked him how much of that, like, he gets on him or, like, how much it changes kind of like his personality. And with everything that's coming up with Holden, how much of that do you feel like kind of gets on you? And, like, what do you do to kind of decompress or, like, I know that Ty likes to try to kill Wes with tequila. So, like, what do you do to try to, like, undo the heaviness?
And
of the show?
And are you walking around ordering around the rest of the cast off camera because you're the captain?
To that, I'll say no comment. I'm definitely not bossy at all. Not at all. I run. I'm a runner. I run every day. It's the way I know how to decompress. And, when you're shooting a show like this, I mean, when I first read the script, what was the initial pull towards it, other than obviously being a fan of the books already, was that the sheer ambition of showing and creating a sci-fi piece of this size and tone had never been done before. And, we are shooting a massive amount of material with enormous sets and, in a storyline that's complex and adult and comprehensive and applies to things that are happening to people today. So you want to obviously give it everything you have to make sure that you're not being disrespectful to people who have maybe gone through something similar. It really is an all encompassing process. I mean, we shoot, long hours most days. I'm there most days. And then we spend the weekends rehearsing for the next week. So the little moments that you get to decompress, whether that's going to the bar for a drink or two after, or, taking a run or whatever is really important, to be able to step away from the kind of heaviness that's going on, within the universe of these characters, just to stay sane and healthy. For me, it was, it's running. I go for a run every day, and that kind of chills me out, clears me up.
Is there anybody that, like, on set, like, you guys, like, kind of, like, play jokes or anything? I think I heard, like, half of, I might be messing this up. I think I heard there's something that you guys like to do with, like, accents or something, or impressions or something, or I don't know.
Well, I mean, we're constantly fucking around with each other. I mean, Wes by himself is like a one man like joke, and he always is creating these hilarious situations. He's such a jokester. But we have a really kind of fun, playful energy between everybody on set. It's we all really dig each other, and not just the cast, but the crew as well. And we're a really tight bunch. So we're constantly messing with each other, like setting up traps and, and laughing. traps.
Like bear traps?
Just like...
Like you paint the tunnel on the wall?
Joke bear traps. That you
know, like, yeah.
And
totally
you're just made fun of
like
mercilessly.
Can I tell you guys my favorite on-screen joke moment between Wes and Steven? Because it's fantastic.
Go for it.
They're filming a scene together where they're talking to each other, and Wes is trying to make Steven laugh. So when Steven's delivering his line, Wes is like making funny faces and thrusting his hips at him. And then in the middle of the scene, Steven goes, "Wes, they've turned around. You're the one on camera right now."
That may be like my favorite moment on set, period, for the last 2 years. It's amazing.
The footage of that. The footage of that has to come out at some point, right? We need a leaker for that one.
Dude, and to think he's the father of two children.
That's right. Yeah. Good times.
So you said you're a fan of sci-fi. Like, what are some other things that you like? Like, before, you know, we know that you read the books and you're a fan of the books beforehand, but what is some other sci-fi you like? And would you ever, you know, do you want to stay working in this genre? Do you want to, like, branch out?
Well, in terms of working and picking roles, I really don't pick based on genre, really. It's all based on character and writing and, you know, who's involved. You know, for me, I mean, The Expanse is obviously a sci-fi epic and classic. But what I connected to most about it was the people, you know, as I was saying earlier. And for most of the sci-fi that I like, and that I'm drawn to, it's usually the same, but that's the same for every genre that I watch. You know, it could be comedy or drama or, you know, period drama, or whatever. It's always the characters and the people, that I'm drawn to. And, in terms of other sci-fi that I've liked in the past, I mean, you know, in literature, Philip K. Dick, you know, in film, early Ridley Scott. I like stuff that reflects a sense of realism, mostly because I feel like the greatest strength of science fiction as a genre in and of itself is to be able to talk about very difficult things, politically and personally, that you might find is difficult to express in a present context because people feel passionately about them. But with sci-fi, you're able to make it more digestible and have this kind of honest conversation about almost anything you want, especially in the political sphere and even in the philosophical one. So, and certainly the personal one. So, you know, to that strength, there's really no limit on what, where you can go and how far you can push and what you can talk about and what, and that piece of science fiction to me is the coolest part about it.
That was very deep. I liked it. Why is nobody else? I was like, no one else is talking anymore. Everybody else is talking.
Also, lasers. Lasers are cool.
And lasers are super, super cool.
Let's talk a little bit about this week, though. Like, Miller's plan.
It happens.
So I don't want to obviously go into spoiler territory because we kind of have an idea of what's going to happen after this. But can we talk a little bit about, like, how he came up with this and where, you know, Naomi's, he's really, like, affected by his decision right now, which is a little surprising. It seems like they kind of had a bond and she's the most affected. And actually, even Holden's, which you can speak to this, seems a little emotional about what's going on.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, that is all true.
Everything you just said, that all absolutely happened.
All right. Yeah. Good talk, everybody.
You guys are killing me right now. I'm like, I'm home, I'm sick, and you guys are killing me. Come on.
But it's so much fun.
Yeah, you have
to be difficult.
Good game. Good game, everybody.
Good game. Good game, guys. Good
I fun. Hope everybody I hope everybody out there hears what I have to go through with you guys.
Hey, Cher, tell us more things that happened.
I guess my specific question is how much scientific research for you guys went into, like, concocting the whole firing the Nauvoo at Eros and pushing it into the sun plan. Even when it comes down to the games people play on space stations, there was a lot of scientific thought that went into that. So I'm curious as to how this was concocted.
We did enough research to realize that the math of throwing something into the sun is really, really, really hard. And so we said there were very smart people on Tycho and just kind of left it at that. Seriously, though, it's very hard to throw something in the sun. It's the math on that one is extensive.
Is it harder or easier than throwing something? Because I think of landing rovers on Mars, when that happened, I was like, oh my God, we threw something at Mars and hit it. Is that throwing something at the sun even harder than that?
Yeah, it actually is. It's incredibly, it's really easy to slingshot things around the sun, but actually getting one to go into it is pretty difficult. The nice thing about being out in the asteroid belt, though, is it actually makes it easier. The farther you are from the sun, the easier it is to change your orbital trajectory so that you fall into it. So we did have the advantage of being out in the asteroid belt to do it. But yeah, the math is pretty complex. Most things that you throw at the sun will actually just sort of whip around the sun and come back at you.
And the closer you are to the sun, the harder it is to get something to land in it.
See, this ruins my whole plan, because that was my dream when I die, was to have my body shot into the sun. So this is throwing a wrench into everything.
You better get on that math, dude.
I know.
You better get on that math.
I know. Yeah. What are you, Hunter Thompson? Like, what is this?
I want the energy in my body to return to the cosmic forge from whence it came. That's all.
And you said I was deep.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah,
I know.
There you go.
You're like a puddle, dude. This is crazy.
My plan is to go back to med school.
Really? So that's your plan when you die, is to go back to med school?
Yeah, just the hard way.
Is that like some kind of purgatory, or is that like...
No.
I never made it through cadaver lab. So I'm
going to
try one more time.
Ah, there you go.
Oh, I got it.
You can see things from the other side.
If there was a good place, then in your good place, you'd be in med school. Steven, do you watch The Good Place? Because we all were talking about the show before.
Dude,
I don't know. What is The Good Place? I've never even heard of The Good Place.
You are one of today's lucky 10,000, dude.
I'm so excited. What is it?
It's a show? Soon as you hang up with us, you have to go on Hulu and binge watch The Good Place.
Yeah.
Oh,
awesome. Don't ask any too many questions. Just go watch, and then when you're done, come back and talk to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's by did you like The Office or Parks and Rec?
No.
Yeah.
This is the same writer. This one is made for Steven. Steven has a deeper philosophical education than almost anybody I've ever met. This is going to scratch his itch.
Okay,
if you're into deep stuff, watch it.
Seriously. It's a sitcom with philosophy.
Yeah.
Steven is the one that when he and I were getting drunk in a hotel room at 3 o'clock in the morning, we spent the whole time talking about Marcus Aurelius.
I heard about that. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. This place is going to be a fine fit.
I do want to ask actually one more science/depiction of science question, and that was the Eros moving away at the last minute moment. And when I read that in the book, and this is probably just having to do with, you know, not having the proper image of the scope of space, it was like this sudden thing where it like just, you know, jolted out of the way, and it seemed much more stately in the way it happened in the show. Can you guys talk a little bit about that and depicting it that way versus as this sudden, violent, big moment?
The thing you have to keep in mind with the way it was shot is that it was shot from Detective Miller's perspective. So sitting there on the asteroid when it moves, the weirdness of it is that he doesn't feel anything, that there's no sudden jerky movement, that it just sort of seems to be in one place and then it sort of seems to be in another place. And we really wanted to play up the weirdness of that. So shooting it all from his perspective allowed us to do that. Now, from everyone else's perspective, it launched itself out of the way at high speed. But that's from the outside. If you were actually sitting on the rock like he was, it felt very, very smooth.
Yeah, that it did that is weird. That it did that is one of the weirds.
It was very cool. I loved that shot of the ship just like... majestically soaring overhead. It really kind of gave you a sense of the scope of the thing.
Payoff that we get with Eros moving. Eros moving is only a thing of awe and wonder if you have spent a season and a half being restricted to classical physics. I mean, this is the payoff for all of that time we spent thinking about inertia and how gravity works and how spin works and how, and having that be a constraint all the way through. Now we see something that maybe that doesn't apply to, and that should be scary. You know, that if we had artificial gravity all the way through, it wouldn't be scary.
And it made for a great cliffhanger for the end of the episode too.
Yeah. And looked cool.
There's nothing like ending
really
an episode.
Cool.
There's nothing like ending an episode on the words, "What the fuck?" Like, that was just really, I was like, that is the perfect button on this scene.
No, he actually did. He did message me with, he ended with "what the fuck" at the end of it. So
yeah,
he's not lying about that.
Awesome.
So why don't we, and Stephen, you can like join in this part. Like, we do a shout out at the end of the podcast where we kind of shout out other things that are like sci-fi or genre related that we're into. So if you have something, feel free to like contribute it. But hi, Daniel, what are you into right now that you want to shout out?
Mm.
Or don't say anything.
I'll start. Jesus.
There you
Christ,
go.
You two.
That's the captain taking charge right there.
We're trying to get Stephen on it.
I feel like I was the last person to see Arrival, and I was blown the fuck away. Arrival was amazing.
Oh, that is such a good movie.
I haven't seen it yet.
Stephen, did you meet him when he was on set?
Ted Chiang, did
you meet him when he was there?
Yes. I did.
Okay.
It was awesome to meet him. And the director of Arrival is one of my favorite directors working today. I mean, I must have seen Sicario like 3 or 4 times. It's
so that means you're looking
movie.
Forward to Blade Runner.
I am.
I really like
very,
yeah.
You know, to
I
be
really
honest
like
with you,
Sicario.
I that director, Denis Villeneuve, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He can do no wrong. I mean, the guy is just, every film he's done is just absolutely beautiful, and Arrival is gorgeous. I mean, I've been obsessed with it over the last like week or so.
How excited are you for Blade Runner then?
Dude, I'm trying not to think about it because I'm such a huge fan of the first one. And I'm such a huge fan of this director who's doing the remake. It's just going to be so killer. Can't wait to see what they do with it. He always has such original ways of showing things. It's going to be awesome.
I was going to say, as a sci-fi fan, it's really great when you get a director like that, who you know has just like film chops, to come in and start doing genre stuff. It's really, it's very exciting.
I think the Batman, the Nolan Batman trilogy is so good for that exact reason, because he's a really
good
director when he came in, and that's my personal take. I haven't seen Arrival yet, so I can't say anything about it.
It's so good. Everyone should see
it. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. It's awesome. It's a great movie.
Do you feel that Amy Adams was robbed in the Oscar nominations?
I do, actually. She was so wonderful in this movie. It was incredibly lyrical and interesting, and her performance was intelligent and layered. And she really just puts you right there.
This is what she was snubbed. That would have been her 5th or 6th nomination if she got nominated.
Oh, I don't know.
She's been nominated
it's
a bunch
there,
of times.
Though. Yeah, she has. She won for, what was it, Doubt? It was Doubt, right? I forget which one she won for. But
was that was supporting, not Best Actress, right? It was supporting.
That was supporting. Yeah, that was supporting. She's amazing.
Like,
I mean, she's an incredible, incredible actor.
So I didn't mean to do it, but so far this year, I'm only reading sci-fi books by women authors. I'm finishing up books right now by an author named Cameron Hurley. She's got a book just coming out called The Stars Are Legion, kind of a space opera book that's I'm really excited to be reading. And then I just finished up some stuff by one of my other favorite writers, Sherry Priest, who I just finished up her series that started with Maplecroft. So that's what I've been reading.
Is that series done? Is it finished? Like wrapped?
Yeah, Maplecroft and Chapelwood actually wound up just being 2 books. She had more that she could have done, but she stopped after 2.
Because I have this ongoing thing with science fiction and fantasy right now, is that other than the Expanse novels, because those are amazing, of course.
And they're available in Orbit Books.
There you go. There you go. I had to put that out there, but with trying to find like sci-fi and fantasy novels that stand on their own, you know, without being part of a series, And that is really hard to find these days without being, you know, part of a 10-part run. You know, it's a tough thing.
If you like gothic Cthulhu-esque horror, Maplecroft and Chapelwood are two fantastic books. They tell a complete story. You will not regret reading them.
Excellent.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to give a little shout-out, because I just got a preview copy of our buddy Chuck Wendig's Thunderbird, his latest in his Miriam Black series. So I'm going to start that. And I'm going to give it a shout-out, just because it's Chuck, and we like him. He's
very
a friend
cool.
of the pod.
He's a good guy.
If
you're looking, the other thing I would just mention, if you're looking for a standalone fantasy, Uprooted by Naomi Novik, I think won the Nebula last year, and is it's a lovely book.
Ah, excellent.
One volume, whole story, start to finish.
I'm writing that down right now. That's great. Okay. So those are our shout outs.
I guess that's it for this week.
Yeah, that was episode 3 of The Churn. Thank you guys for joining us. Thank you, Steven, so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Hey, man. Thank you guys for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Fun. Absolutely. And Ty and Daniel,
as
always.
And hopefully you'll be back soon. And Ty and Daniel, it's been real.
Yeah. We'll talk to you next time, because we just do that every week. But we want to thank everybody at home for listening. And definitely please, as I said at the top of the episode, rate us, review us on iTunes, subscribe. Lots more coming as we round out season 2 of the Expanse. I shouldn't say round out. There's still so much left of season 2 of the Expanse. So a lot of exciting stuff to come. And again, always hit us up on Twitter at Sci-Fi Wire or in the comments on this podcast story. And thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.